This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, my guest is the protest singer David Rovics, who by my count has 14 CDs out already. Amy Goodman calls him the musical version of Democracy Now! Cindy Sheehan says he's the peace poet and troubadour of our time. His latest CD is Halliburton Boardroom Massacre, and we'll be talking about that one and hopefully hearing him play a few songs from it during this half hour. David Rovics, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
It's a real pleasure to meet you finally. Actually, the second time I've mentioned, the first time I've talked to you on the radio. And so I don't know the answer really to this very basic question. How and why did you become a protest singer?
Well, I kind of got into music because my parents are both musicians. They're both classical musicians. And so I played classical cello growing up. And then I was at a camp called Roe Camp in Western Massachusetts, a wonderful little Unitarian-run camp in the town that used to have the oldest online nuclear reactor in the country in it. And this was when I was 12 in 1979, and the anti-nuke movement was in full swing, and folks were coming through with guitars and skits and all kinds of stuff to the camp. So that was actually... I think my first exposure to this kind of music was actually Al Giordano, who now edits Narco News out of Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America. Great news website.
And when did you pick up a guitar?
I picked up a bass, and then it was too heavy to walk around in the woods with, so I picked up a guitar when I was late teens and started getting into it in a more serious way in my early 20s.
I heard you in an interview. I heard you played in the subway system of Boston
for many years, full time, summer, winter. Yep,
that must have been kind of odd at the beginning.
It's fantastic, actually. I really miss it, honestly.
And, what do you like about it so much?
Well, for one thing, the main thing I miss about it is reaching a cross-section of society, because as it is, barred from the corporate media completely and, like so many other independent musicians, especially political ones, it's really tough to get outside of progressive circles. It's progressives who are organizing gigs. The progressives are the ones they know. Those are the ones who come to the shows, in the subways, yeah, you just play for everybody, and that's wonderful. And I always found that most people, when I was playing in the subways, I was doing mostly other people's songs, but same kind of songs, just not my own stuff, and people tended to really like it, and yeah, never really offended anybody, as far as I know. Nobody ever said, oh, you yelled at me. Once, one guy told me I was unpatriotic. Some World War II vet got mad.
Do you remember the song you were singing that provoked that?
I think it was the Draft Dodger Rag. Uh-huh.
And did you find that your skill improved by playing in the subways?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, vastly. And that's I always recommend it to musicians who look like they need practice, but they're not, can't really quite get up the gumption to do it themselves in their homes. Go to the subways and use an amplification system, because it's too loud. You don't want to develop a style where you're banging on your guitar just to be heard. You want to use amplification or play in a really quiet subway. But unfortunately, all the quiet ones are, it's mostly illegal in this country to play in the subways. Like Washington, D.C., it's illegal. Atlanta, it's illegal. San Francisco, it's illegal.
Is it illegal in Boston?
No, in Boston, it's legal, because Stephen Baird with the Street Artists Guild in the early 70s sued the city of Boston and won. And so they had a settlement which laid out the details of, the legality of playing both in the subways and the streets.
And are there people still playing? A lot of people still playing in the
subways? Loads of people, yeah. And, some of them are making a good living at it and others aren't, depending on various factors. But, it's a thriving street music scene, probably one of the best in the country.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is the protest singer David Rovics. His latest CD, by the way, is Halliburton Boardroom Massacre. You mentioned being banned from corporate media, that the corporate media doesn't play protest music. Why is that?
Well, there's, you know, there's some folks who fall through the cracks, and most of them are people that have already been political since long before the ban. You know, there was, as you know, a brief period in the 1960s when this kind of music was actually mainstream and played on the radio, and, you know, lots of factors involved with that. But, you know, people like Bruce Springsteen and you know, Neil Young can get away with doing it, but, you know, for most of us, you know, if we're not famous already, you know, then they're not gonna, you're not gonna get signed, and you're not gonna get on the radio. They only play major label artists anyway. So, first of all, you got to be on a major label to get on corporate radio, and then even if you're on a major label, you know, then there's still, you know, there's still a lot of factors.
David Robicks, did it tick you off when Neil Young said he was waiting for someone in a generation younger than his to play a protest song, and he didn't hear anyone do an anti-Bush, anti-war song, so he took it upon himself to do it?
Yeah, it really ticked me off a lot, you know, because, you know, what planet does this guy live on? You know, does he ever leave Hollywood? I mean, you know, it's just, he's so obviously out of touch with reality. And I guess it's hard to stay in touch with reality when you're that rich and that famous. You know, he could at least make a bit of an effort to, you know, it's not hard. You look on the internet, you know, it's interesting. If you do a web search, anybody listening, do a web search for protest music. And what you'll come up with is a whole bunch of newspaper articles in publications like the New York Times saying, why is protest music dead? And then you'll come up with a whole bunch of websites of musicians like me, Jim Page, Riot Folk, Emma's Revolution, all kinds of folks like the ones on my links page on my website who are thriving, you know, alive and well doing this stuff. But of course, most of us are going around playing for audiences of 2 or 3 dozen people.
Mm, that website, by the way, is davidrovics.com. How do you make a go of it if you never played on the radio?
Well, community radio. I get played on the radio in Europe. I'm regularly played on BBC. I've been on national radio in 8 different countries except for this one. It's largely through the internet and live performances and word of mouth. And the internet helps a lot. There's been well over 500,000 downloads from my website. And so there's obviously people interested in this stuff, looking around for it. And the internet is shaking stuff up. And of course, you know, as I'm sure you know, the record sales for the major artists are down dramatically because of downloads.
Now, you self-release your own CDs and you throw them right up there on the web for free. Why do you distribute that way?
Well, most of my CDs have been self-released, but my new one is actually distributed by Caroline Distribution. It can actually be found in the stores, and I've also been on a couple other independent labels like Damon Records, Amy Ray's label from Atlanta, AK Press, and others. But it's pretty much a DIY operation, and I put all the stuff up for free for a number of reasons. Partly because out of wanting to get the stuff out there so that people will hear it. I think there may be an economic argument to be made. I'm not sure, but there may be an economic argument to be made for putting it all up for free. I think that what happens is it behaves a lot like airplay. I mean, when, you know, even if you put it up, not just streaming, but downloads, you know, people download the stuff, but they spread the word about it. And maybe, you know, most musicians make a living, if they're making a living, they're making a living performing. And so, you know, you get gigs out of it. If you get 1,000 downloads and one person out of 1,000 is going to organize a paying gig for you, well, there you go. You're gonna, you know, you've, you know, a few thousand of those, you know, you're making a living.
Tell me about Halbert and Boardroom Massacre. In particular, the title song, which suggests at least that a returning Iraq war vet might want to go to the Halliburton annual meeting and blow the place up, or go to the Halliburton boardroom. Are you really advocating that?
Well, you know, I don't know. The song isn't necessarily, I wouldn't say I'm advocating it or not advocating it, but the song is more an act of preemptive songwriting. It's more saying, like, you know, from my various many conversations with returning Iraq war veterans, and I recommend anybody out there, you know, meet some of these folks and talk to them, as they got a lot to say, if you can get them to start talking in the first place. You know, people are very, very, very angry, and they're, you know, they're angry that they've been sent off to Iraq to fight a war for oil, and they're angry that they've been, you know, in order to follow procedures, many of them have ended up killing children and killing all kinds of other innocent civilians. And they're angry about it, and they're not feeling peaceful, and they're not they're not necessarily interested in putting down their weapons. They're just interested in aiming them at somebody who they feel deserves to be shot. And the kinds of conversations that I heard, I thought, okay, well, this seems like about as likely to happen as the flood is about as a hurricane is about likely to hit New Orleans. And so I figured, instead of writing the song after the flood, I'll write it before. And
how do you encounter these veterans? Do they come to your shows?
They come to my shows. They sing my songs. They were hanging out at Camp Casey and other places where Cindy Sheehan is to be found, and I've done a lot of events with her. And they go to Veterans for Peace conferences, and I've sung at several Veterans for Peace conferences. And especially, there was a lot of them at the Dallas conference a year before last summer.
Well, why don't you sing a song from Halliburton Boardroom Massacre? The one I wanted you to start with is When Johnny Came Marching Home Again, which deals with just this issue.
Got off the plane, looked at no one. Walked down the tarmac in the direction of nowhere. Followed the sun as it was setting. Glad to be done with all the bloodletting. There were no banners for the proud and the few. Just workers in airports do what they do. Fuel up the planes, unload the bags, along with the coffins all covered in flags. When Johnny came marching home, the town he was from was a dead little place. So he looked for a job somewhere off base. In this city of pawn shops, hotels and bars, gas stations, strip clubs, highways and cars. He went to a dive, ordered a beer, said turn the music up loud so it's all that I hear. Try to rewind, turn back the years, stop the explosions between my ears. When Johnny came marching home, well, the jobs were all crap, the beer was cheap, and besides there was no other way he could sleep. Still the screams and the guns would wake him at night, and he was always on edge and ready to fight. And when he closed his eyes, he would just see the face of a woman he killed in some faraway place. Over and over, the white of her eye, and her final and terrible, terrified cry. When Johnny came marching home, health fell apart, with an ache in the joints and a thump in the heart. The doctor just told him it's all in his head, but he couldn't stop drinking or get out of bed. And with no place to go but the wrong way, it was a shock to his ears when he heard himself say over and over to anyone within range, hey mister, can you spare some change? When Johnny came marching home,
that's David Rovics from his new CD, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre, the song When Johnny Came Marching Home. Really tragic, sad song. David Rovics, how are we going to stop this war? We got a huge majority of Americans, almost 2-1, who say the war's not worth it, and yet the war is going on. Bush is not stopping.
Yeah, I mean, even people at I can't remember who was being interviewed at a Republican congressman's fundraiser, and even people at this guy's fundraiser were against the war. I mean, it's and even though he's not, I mean, it's really when you got a situation where the vast majority of Democrats in the Congress are supporting the war, and the vast majority of people who vote Democrat, like 95%, are against the war, and then now increasingly more and more Republicans and others are against it. It's it's kind of crazy. And how are we going to stop it? I mean, where's the mass movement? We need a mass movement. We need a huge militant mass movement that doesn't just have protests every few months, but actually is in the streets, you know, throwing their bodies into the gears of the machines. You know, that's what we need, but it seems to me. But we sure don't have it, and I sure don't know how we're going to get it.
I know you're giving some of the proceeds of Halliburton Boardroom Massacre to United for Peace and Justice, the largest umbrella peace group here in the United States, and you sing at a lot of peace rallies and, mm-hmm. and demonstrations. So you've got a sense as to the extent of the mobilization. I agree with you. We've got to redouble those efforts, though. And my worry is, you know, Bush doesn't care, and a lot of the Democrats don't care.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think we sure need a third party, you know, and I... You know, if we can drag the Democrats to the left, that's great. That's been tried a lot, and it hasn't worked. But that's, you know, but if we could, you know, our political system is morally bankrupt, and we don't have a democracy, and we've never had a democracy. We have, you know, certain trappings of democracy enough to keep a lot of people thinking that we live in a democracy. But you know, democracy and prosperity don't go hand in hand, and we arguably don't have prosperity either. When you got, you know, 1 in 5 kids going to bed hungry, I mean, that's the only way you could have the kind of economic draft that, you know, that sustains, you know, allows our military to exist. Nobody would be going to, you know, fight in Iraq if they weren't trying to get, you know, college money. It's just...
Yeah, these economic issues too just are not talked about very much by hardly anybody, and we saw really the dire circumstance both of race and class of economic and racial oppression down, of course, at Katrina in New Orleans. And you got a song called New Orleans, another powerful song off of this Halliburton Boardroom Massacre CD. You've been to New Orleans before, I take it. When was the last time you were there?
I usually tour a lot. I tour most of the time, mostly around the U.S. and quite a bit in Europe. And I usually play in New Orleans about once a year or so, or sometimes more often. And I love New Orleans. I've spent quite a bit of time there over the years. When I used to play in a band where the main Chris Chandler, where the writer of all the material, lived in New Orleans, and so we practiced a lot there and played a lot there, and it's a wonderful town, or it certainly was a wonderful town, and I was pretty familiar with the place with all its ups and downs, and certainly representative of so many of the good and bad things about this country. I mean, the home of jazz music and also the home of desperate poverty and racism that's really apparent.
And police brutality and all of that.
Yeah, lots of that.
And so tell me how you decided to write New Orleans. I read you wrote it shortly, almost days after the flood. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wrote it. Yeah, during the time while everybody was dying in the Superdome and dying in their attics and everywhere else. I was actually in Beirut, Lebanon at the time.
That's kind of strange.
Kind of strange, huh? A friend of mine from Beirut was showing me around Lebanon, and I went there in Jordan and a couple weeks in the West Bank. And
I know you've written a lot of courageous songs about what's going on in the occupied territories, too. So I'm not surprised that you've been over there, but to be there at the same time from remote to see what's going on in this country, which made this country look like a third world country, too.
Oh, it sure did. I mean, everybody was shocked, you know. I mean, including lots of people in this country who are not necessarily, you know, friends of the oppressed, but I think everybody universally around the world was just appalled at that. You know, how could the journalists be getting in there to cover all this stuff, and, you know, but nobody else can get in there with ambulances and whatever else, you know. But, I could have written the song, you know, years before, of course, because I actually, you know, unlike members of our government who are supposed to be paying attention to these things, I was actually reading, you know, articles in the Times-Picayune that were spread around on the internet, and I was familiar with the idea of what was going to happen when a Category 5 hurricane hit New Orleans, which the general consensus in the scientific community was that it would break the levees and it would cause many thousands, possibly as many as 100,000 deaths. You know, and I was actually thinking for years before the flood of writing the song, and the song would have been very much like it is.
Do you mind playing for it?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear, the future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. In National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, that it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said. Now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted. Inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, 'cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans. New Orleans. New Orleans. Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan. It was just if the waters rose, get out if you can. There were no buses, no one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. And the people died. Then they died some more. They drowned inside their attics, an army of the poor. An army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember those sad and awful days, when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water, they died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Now the city is in ruins, a massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. 500,000 refugees, here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth. Where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is the place we're heading towards. Where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans.
That's David Rovix singing, of course, New Orleans from his latest CD, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre. You can find that at davidrovix.com. That's R-O-V-I-C-S.com. With all the horror around us at New Orleans, the Iraq War, our wounded veterans, how do you manage to see what's beautiful and not get too down?
Well, there's so many beautiful things in the world. I mean, it is a beautiful place, even as all this stuff is happening. And I would probably be writing a lot more love songs if it weren't for just the feeling that I guess I'm reacting to a large extent to what's out there on the radio. I think it's more well-rounded really to write a not just songs about world events, but also songs about your personal life. But the thing that annoys me is that that's what most people are doing, so, or at least most people that get on the radio and stuff. So I tend to react against that by emphasizing other stuff. But the world is in all its horror, it's a beautiful place. There's so many good people. Most people are good people. They're nice people. They're generous. They're kind, loving. I mean, there's The trees are beautiful, you know, sitting by the fire is beautiful, you know, there's so many, you know, hot tubs are great. I mean, there's a lot of good things in life.
You end the CD, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre, with a love song called Life is Beautiful. And it was just kind of a nice way to take the listener out of that CD. And if you could play it here, I think it'd be a nice way to get toward the end of our conversation, David Rovins.
Mm-hmm. You bet. You're sitting here in front of me, floating in a cloud. Your chocolate eyes meet mine, you're whispering out loud. Thoughts that make me shiver, words that make me melt, and I can only be thankful for the deal I've been dealt, for the birds outside this window, for this guitar on my knee, for the smile on your lips, for the good you found in me. Looking at the wood stove and the towels upon the sink, with your fingers on my forehead, all that I can think is life is beautiful. For the way you kiss my fingers, for the way you hold my hands, for the way you look in those leather pants, for the times like now when I just gotta roll another smoke, breathe deeply for a moment and take another toke. Life is beautiful. When it's over and the afternoon is done, we can spend the evening dreaming of the rising of the sun. And even when the shadows look me right in the eye, I feel your heart within my belly like the stars up in the sky. Life is beautiful. Life is beautiful.
So that's David Rovics, protest singer, singing a love song, the last song on his CD, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre, with the song Life is Beautiful, which I enjoyed quite a lot. You can find out more about David Rovics at davidrovics.com. That's rovics.com. One thing that's beautiful in your life, according to what I've read, David, is you're a dad.
Yeah, I got a beautiful baby daughter named Layla. Yeah, she's just 9 months old now, and it's a great pleasure, and it makes touring a little less fun. I keep on wanting to be home.
I can imagine. I bet you'll have a lot more songs inspired by your daughter in the years to come. David Rovics, been a real pleasure for me finally to be able to sit down and have you in the studio with me. I do commend this CD, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre, to our listeners. And David Rovics is a troubadour. He will play at your protests and demonstrations if you invite him and make it worth his while. He's not greedy. He just needs to pay the transportation in a little bit to make it possible for him to do what he does so well. David Rovics, thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.